Hello, everyone. I am Glenn Moyes.
And I'm Adam Weber. And you can hear me now.
Yay. Yeah, we are using some new hardware.
I got rid of the tin can that I was talking into. I just had this... Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, also known as a MacBook.
Yeah, also known as a MacBook that has its own little microphone in there, laptop microphone, and yeah, I'm recording into real hardware now.
Yeah, last week, if you listened to our podcast, you probably noticed that the audio quality was different. I sounded great, but Adam sounded like normal, and the...
As in crappy.
Yeah, and the comparison was a little too much. Because before, the way we've been doing these podcasts is we just record we have this little Skype recorder MP3 thingy, and then we just use that. But last week, I recorded my part separately. He recorded his part separately. Then I combined the files over here. And we're still going to do that, except Adam now has this. It was a Christmas present. Same exact hardware that I have. Microphone, stand, preamp. Yeah.
You know, the running joke is it was a Christmas present to both of us, because when I'm talking to him through Skype, now I don't sound like I'm talking into a tin can on Glenn's end. You know, for me, Glenn sounded great and I could hear myself just fine, but, you know.
Yeah, when we're on Skype and stuff, but when he actually gets to hear it, you know, what he really sounds like, it's like, oh, man.
Yeah. Well, I hated hearing it on the podcast. I would listen to our own podcast after we record it, see how it turned out, and it wasn't pretty.
Yeah, so we fixed that really quick.
Yeah, all fixed.
Yeah, I think it was actually the next day, wasn't it?
It might have been a couple of days later. I can't remember, but it's fixed.
Yeah, it's like as soon as you actually got to hear the podcast, we talked about it, and then I ordered the stuff. So, but anyway, so. Yes, we're high tech now. We're now legit.
Yay.
Yeah, we are now using recording hardware that costs more than $100. So we're legit now.
I guess that makes it... I guess legitimacy is measured in the cost of your toys.
Yeah, pretty much.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
Hello, everyone. This is Glenn from A Week Later. The irony of the conversation that Adam and I just had is that roughly at the 1 hour and 37 minute mark, it is my voice that sounds like it's coming out of a tin can. The reason behind this is that during the process of doing the post-production on this podcast, while I was doing the denoise, I decided to save over the original source file instead of making a backup, and my computer crashed because I had the gall to move a browser window that had Flash video running on it from monitor 1 to monitor 2. So thank you, Adobe Flash. You have yet again figured out another way to inconvenience my life. But the good news is that VLC, which apparently can play everything, including corrupted Windows files, did manage to save the first 3/4 of the audio. So, but I didn't want to re-record the last 30 minutes again. So my voice is just going to sound like the way it did in Skype. Just to give you some fair warning that your speakers are fine, it is just my computer crashed. Okay, back to our regularly scheduled podcast. So, alrighty. So what we're going to do for today's podcast, while we're still trying to get stuff ready for the Animation Academy, we thought it might be interesting to do an origin story of both myself, Adam, and Lumaglyph, the name of our studio, just so we can kind of get this out of the way so we don't have to do this again, you know, the origin story, because, yeah. and now since we're a little bit closer to our actual origin, you know, doing an origin story now as opposed to 10 years in the future when we've forgotten, you know, most of the stuff about how we started.
Well, what else will be fun about this is that other people, or another podcast, I mean, we can always refer back to this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I'm always really big about, you know, keeping a production journal, having all of your discoveries and conflicts, having all of that recorded down so that you don't forget how you learned and you don't forget, you know, what made things work and what made things not work. Because a successful project, or even a poorly executed one, does kind of screw with your mind as far as, you know, what to do next time, you know.
There will be a quiz.
There will be a quiz. Yes, there will be a quiz. So Adam, let's go ahead and start with you as far as your origin story.
Oh yeah, I was born at a very young age. No, my passion is stories. I love stories. And my mother will tell you, I was a little kid. I'd follow around the house and I'd tell her my stories. And a lot of it would be made up as I go. But I think what actually the origin of that, going back even further, my grandfather used to tell us these stories. It was Daniel Boone stories. And they were very simple. They followed a very simple formula. You had this little Daniel Boone character and his sister, and they go out and sneak out in the middle of the night and get on their horse Smokey, and then go off on this adventure. They would have some sort of threat, and he'd pull out his magic tomahawk, and it would handle whatever the threat was, and then they'd get back before their parents saw them. And I never figured out when these characters slept, because they were out all night. But what happened with this, with these simple stories, was it really sparked my little imagination. I would go around, I would come up with all these stories of my own. I was just fascinated by how this worked. You create this fantasy world. You could go anywhere in the context of a story. And I've been a real nerd about this thing growing up. And I remember, like, I don't remember how old I was when I came up with my first one, but the problem that I had was I had no understanding of what it was that made a good story, how they worked. And they were very derivative. That you when you read a story written by me at the time, or you can see this in a lot of authors today that are less experienced, is they tend to be very derivative. They tend to be very simple. If there are three pathways to the end goal, they always take the simplest. You tend to have very stupid villains, cookie-cutter villains, cookie-cutter heroes, and they're very, very predictable because of this. Because this is all stuff you've seen before. And I was certainly a victim of this.
Me too, by the way.
Yeah, well, we all were. I mean, that's part of being a storyteller in the early stages of your journey to becoming good. And like anything else, you know, when you get the further you get into something you're passionate about, the more work you put in, the more you study it, the more feedback you get, you're naturally going to get better at it, you know. And I've been doing this since I was a really little kid. And I really wanted to get into a medium that would allow me to tell my stories. And I felt like I was a terrible writer, and I was at the time. But at the time, I was thinking writer as like a novelist. I was no novelist. I could barely sit through a novel at the time. Well, now I can. Like today, I've always got novels that I'm working on. But back then, there's no way I could write a novel. But I thought, well, I could animate this. Oh, if only I knew. So I started studying animation, This was also, when this happened, this was about the time Toy Story came out, and that really sparked my passion for animation, because I remember 2D animation, I knew that was art, you know, you're drawing, but computer animation, for some reason, it didn't click as art, it clicked as technical. This is a technical skill. So I started learning software. I don't remember what, when I finally got my hands on Maya, it would have been like version 3, but I was using something else before then. Like an early version of Max or whatever it was that I had. I remember I had Bryce 3D, but that was a little bit later. And I got to where I knew these 3D programs like the back of my hand. I knew exactly where everything was. I knew the technical side very well. I could rig characters. I was a high school kid, and I knew rigging. I knew all the technical jargon. And so... About the same time, it was about 1998, I think it was. Yeah, it was 1998 in August. I started writing the first serious story, or at least then I thought was the first serious story which was at the time called the Superhuman Project. You can see what that I was still in the very derivative, simple mindset. It was later renamed actually at Glenn's suggestion. He came up with that title.
Yeah, and I'm probably going to bleep that out so we can, you know, that because that's a Lumaglyph project.
Okay. The title that has just been bleeped out, you probably won't bleep out the old title.
No. Because it's amusing.
The Superhuman Project? Yeah. It's pretty amusing. If someone saw a film called The Superhuman Project, they probably wouldn't go see it. I'll get into that in a second. But yeah, it had all of those problems, you know, because I was in middle school when I started writing this thing. It was very derivative, very simple, always took the path of least resistance. And, you know, if you want to see a good example of contemporary writing, a popular story that's like this, you can read Aragon. It's got all these same problems. And it's not that that author is incapable of writing a good story. It was just inexperience, you know. They're all touting, oh, he's 16 years old when he wrote this, and well, it shows. But it's a classic example of the problems that inexperienced or very poor writers have. And all of us, anybody who's going to get into writing is going to start that way. There's nothing wrong with that as long as you recognize, hey, I've got a long ways to go, and start on that journey. So then I start thinking, okay, well, I'm gonna animate this. And when I got into college, I started taking classes at community college, and they offered computer animation classes. And so in my mind, oh, this is just awesome. They teach computer animation, and I'm gonna be able to animate for reels and make this stuff for reels. Now, of course, the person who taught the class really was about as inexperienced as I was. And if you would have asked me at the time, I probably wouldn't have said I was inexperienced. But now I'm 10 times as experienced as I was then, and now I recognize that I'm inexperienced. But maybe that you make some metaphor about the more I know, the more I realize I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same kind of thing. So I go in there, and the instructor goes up, and he's putting up demo reels, and he's showing us clips from DVD making of. He didn't teach us a thing in there. And so I opened up Maya, and by this point, I knew the software really. It was probably Maya version 5 by then, or 5 or 6 or something like that. And I started modeling a human head. And I knew this really well. This was box modeling that I was using at the time. I later switched to point-to-point, but at the time I was using box modeling, and all the other students looked over what I was doing, and it looked like a head. You know, the proportions were awful. I didn't have the art skills to back it up, but the technical skills were definitely there. I understood edge loops, and I understood how this thing should be constructed. And everyone was just riveted by this. I had people surrounding my computer, and I had to start over at their request and show them how to do what I was doing. And many of the students expressed how they learned more from me in 10 minutes they learned from the instructor in the 3 weeks of the class. And I was, of course, very irritated at that point and dropped it. But that was still before I understood, hey, animation is art. It's not a technical skill. You know, rigging is maybe, but animation is not. And so And I was also a business major at the point, and this is kind of a funny story. You know, all of the art and business classes were in the same building at this particular school. So to get to my business classes, I'd walk past all the artwork, and I'd just be like, I want to do that. And I was always jealous of them, and ended up taking these animation classes and stuff. So I decided that I was going to – when I – was going to transfer to a quote-unquote real school, because I wasn't really learning much from the community college. Their skill level there is about the same as high school. You're not going to learn much more from there than you're going to learn at a high school class. So I went to transfer to BYU Idaho. And when I went to declare my major, course, at my dad's, you know, beating my head, you got to go into business where all the money is, and you need to be able to support a family. And so I go in there, and they have the drop down box, and it was alphabetical, and so there's business, and darn it, what was right above it? Art. And I knew that that was the one thing that could get me into something. Now, of course, in my mind, I want to get into art to tell stories. I'm not thinking I want to be an artist. I want to be a storyteller. And so I signed up for it. And you can imagine how that phone call went. So guess what, Dad? I signed up for school. I declared my major. Oh, that's good. Guess what major I declared? Business? Nope. Guess again. Accounting? Art. If silence could kill. I'll never talk with your mother when I get home.
He said that.
Oh yeah, he said that. Oh my goodness. And now to be fair, I mean he told me later how the conversation went, and he didn't tell me at the time. He basically at the time he said, "Okay, well, go ahead, and we'll talk about this after your first semester up there." Well, I didn't know at the time that my mom actually was an art major at one point at the time it was known as Ricks College, and had determined it was so difficult, was so traumatized by it that she switched to a nutrition major, switched to nutrition, because being a nurse was easier than being an artist. And so they had decided, oh yeah, let him go up there and he'll fall on his ass and then come back and apologize and then switch to business. Well, I went up there and had the mentality, I've got to do good. I've got to prove myself. I put everything I had into becoming as good of an artist as possible. I brought back my artwork, presented to my dad and said, "Behold." And, you know, I've actually still have some of those pieces that I showed him. They weren't that bad. In fact, actually, for as little art experience as I had, because I really had no art experience, remember, storyteller, not necessarily an artist. A lot of these other students up there have been doing art for 10 years all the way through high school since they were little kids. They spent about as much time doing art as I spent telling stories. They were about as passionate as art as I was about stories. And so I was not the top of my class, but I was passionate because it was a means to an end. They were doing art for the sake of art. I was doing art for the sake of stories. And I brought that stuff back. And for such a beginner, it was actually pretty good. And I'll admit that. I'll tell anybody who is at the level that I was then and was doing the art that I was doing then, I'd say, hey, that's good. Because remember, you are only in competition with yourself. You know, you improve and then you are successful. At least that's how I measure success and that kind of a thing. So both my parents were in shock at how well I did, and like I said, they're very supportive now. They've actually laugh about the fact that they, you know, that this ever took place. And yeah, it's like my dad's been very awesome about supporting me up at school and very enthusiastic about it. So it was about this time too, something about learning art. I learned a lesson that was extremely important that I applied to stories, and that is this. I could sit down in an art class. I know I've mentioned this in one of the other podcasts. I'll mention it again anyway. You can hear me now. Mm-hmm. Is that when you're sitting down and doing a drawing, I could be working on this thing for 2 hours, and it would look perfect, and I've got everything nailed. The proportions are right. Man, this is such a good piece. And then the instructor says, hey, why don't you just move aside for a sec? He puts his tracing paper on there, draws all over the tracing paper the correct proportions, then hands it to me, and I see that I'm a mile off, and I could not see it. And the reason why is because it is very difficult to critique yourself. It's very difficult to see problems in your own work. And one of the most important things a artist can do is accept criticism from someone else, accept their critique and their feedback. Once I learned that and became very open to feedback and thriving on it, then my skill just started accelerating. I started actually turning the corner and producing stuff that wasn't bad. Is it great? No. Did it compare to the stuff the instructor did? I sure as hell hope not. They've been doing it for 30 years. But it was way better than anything I was producing before. And again, the only person you can compete with is yourself. And that was when I looked at my own story, because I've been working on you know, then called Superhuman Project. Go ahead and laugh. I started looking at that with new eyes. And I started becoming obsessed with getting feedback on it and finding out what is good about this. What makes this a good story? And I had taken writing classes before then. And I started actually taking several writing classes at BYU Idaho. But there's more than that. I started looking at resources online. I started reading other people's stories. That was when I got into novels and really got into fiction. What makes these stories good? What makes them bad? You know, is there anything about this that I don't like? I started doing this with movies. I would look at that and go, how could I work this? If I was on that writing team, how could I fix this? And it was all about, it was no longer about me. It was about the audience, making it good for the audience. And that was probably my biggest turning point right there when it comes to stories. It was also about this time that the name changed to bleeped out to bleep. That was when the name and actually you can see the results of this turning point where Glenn and I are actually talking about taking that story, which at the time was awful. I had every mistake you could possibly make. I had over 300 characters and names, histories, and backgrounds. Try keeping track of that as an audience. Come on.
Or as a writer.
Or as a writer. You know, if you want to see an example that has that problem, Robert Jordan, his has like 17, mm-hmm. and all of them are important.
Wheel of Time, Exhibit A.
Yeah, I say 17, I meant 1700. And when I was trying to read that book, luckily there are fan sites to keep track of the characters for you. So I'd have to look at the character and find out who this person is. Oh, I remember that guy. Okay. And reading that book was just a chore. I got through book 7 and decided, okay, I've had enough. It's just too much work to keep track of all these characters. And so I learned how to focus it. I learned how to... I learned how the mechanics of plot work. I mean, it was just this big story, and then this happens, and this... You might as well be experiencing an MMO. You know, and I had that problem. But then I later... And this is the reason why we're actually turning it into a Lumaglyph project, is because I later learned, okay, here's how a story works. And I took elements that I already had, cut everything else out, and then, hey, I already have a good story here. I just need to cut out the bullshit. Yeah, I started to learn that all of writing is an art too. You know, we're not just, you're not a writer and an illustrator and an animator. You're an artist. So of course during this period of time I met Glenn, and we started combining forces, and turns out he's into stories as well, and we started comparing notes. And, you know what, when you have two people that are passionate about the same thing and both of us are critical of each other, mm-hmm. he's not going to let me get away with putting a really crappy idea in there. And I won't stand for it either from him.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of funny because, I'll get to how we met later, but yeah, when we started talking, we would talk for like 3-4 I think it was actually one time we talked for like 5 hours.
Oh, there was one time where we were standing out in the cold until almost midnight.
Yeah, and it was crazy. I mean, it was like, you know, I just finished teaching a workshop, and then we just talked for like 4 or 5 hours afterwards, and we're like, dude, we're starving.
Yeah, neither of us have had dinner, and so we're just sitting there like, I just realized what time it is. And I got class early in the morning.
Yeah.
And, oh, crap. You know?
And we just couldn't stop. It was so weird.
Because we're both passionate about the same thing. And we both, I think we both had the same epiphany, you know, that that writing is an art. And it's something that you need to have somebody look at and point out the flaws. Because when I was working on this story, there were a lot of problems in there that I couldn't see until other people started, you know, and getting feedback from my mother, which is probably the only, my mother and my younger brother, they were both, but my younger brother had no understanding. He's like, oh, that's so cool. He was 88 years younger than me. At the time, he was knee high. He's not going to give me useful feedback. And then there's my mother that's just going to approve of everything that I do.
Yeah. You know? How long have you been working on that story?
Since 1998. So, okay. 2011 now, 13 years. But I haven't really been working on it the last couple of years because of Hackberry Hollow. And really, to be fair, that story is going to get a rewrite because I was in the middle of working on that when I started actually turning the corner and started producing, you know, decent stories. And it wasn't just that one. That wasn't the only story that I was doing. I had other ones too. And I learned how to create, you know, good, coherent stories. And then I went to go back to that one. I made like a crude outline, which is what I have right now. And the outline is based on picking out components of the old story. And almost all the ideas that I'm keeping are my later ideas, the ones after I started turning the corner. I don't think there's anything from the original concept that's still there. But it actually, you know, I can describe it in two sentences now. I have a log line for it now. And it has focus. It has only like five characters that are really important. And all the there's still like hundreds of characters there, but of course they're background noise. You know, it's okay to have a whole bunch of people. It's okay to have a rich world, but it has focus. You know, and to make another art metaphor, you could put a rose in front of a whole bunch of green rose bushes, and then have that red flower there. It's okay that all those busy leaves and stuff in the background, because you have this rose in the front that's green, where all the leaves, or the rose is bright red, while the leaves are the complementary green, and then the position, and you focus in on it. You have that focal point. And we did the same thing with our stories. We took our main characters, we made it focus on them, it's about them, and all these other characters happen to be living in the world and interact with them.
Yeah, it was actually something I learned, and for video games it's a little bit different, but the best ones, they the way they do their narrative is just like stuff in the background. Like, I think I was doing a, it was something in episode 2, Half-Life 2, where they just set up like this chair that had a bunch of empty beer bottles, and then there's like this trap for the zombies, and like all they had to do is just put the little props of here's the narrative of what happened right here. You had a guy sitting here shooting zombies or whatever. They just kind of let it there, and they didn't like shove it in your face. They didn't have exposition. They didn't switch to a cutscene. You know, trying to explain the world is just all just kind of there. And as you are focusing on the story, your mind is still going and looking at all this other stuff in the background. And then, like, subconsciously, you're piecing this stuff together, you know.
And, you know, that gives the world so much depth and richness, you know, because when you look at the story and you know, I think all the stories we have planned are like this. Maybe one exception, but that one's a shorter story. But the background, the world, like all these characters in the background, they have names, histories, and backgrounds, even though we don't show that to the audience. And we have all of these hints that you can look at and all these things that indicate that these people are living, breathing individuals that live in this world, and they have a routine and all this other stuff. But we don't talk about it. We don't focus on it. It's just if you stop and you look at the background, and then you can see how rich it is. But if you're just experiencing the story, you won't focus on it, but you will notice it subconsciously. And that'll make the foreground stuff, the lives of the characters, feel more real.
Yeah, it's like they say, you know, it's like when people don't notice that you're doing something, that's when you realize you're doing your job, kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's like all these elements work best when they're not noticed.
Yeah, you know, an animation is working when people don't think, oh, wow, that was an awesome animation. That was really well executed, you know?
Yeah, when they don't even notice that it's animated.
Yeah.
Yeah, as soon as they forget that this is an animated character, you did your job. So that's me.
Okay. Yeah, my origin story is a little bit more convoluted. I don't know. It's
Well, it
I
may be because, see, I wanted to be a story writer from the beginning. I've everything that I did was in service of that goal.
Yeah, and I had to kind of discover what I wanted to do. And in retrospect, like it was all there, but I just didn't realize it. I grew up in a family of like well, my dad's an engineer. My two older brothers are like these big computer nerds. And of course, you know, just by being in that environment, because I think like when I was shortly after I was born, we actually had a TI-99/4A PC or personal computer, which is basically a computer that plugged into your TV set. You know, I had a keyboard and a cartridge slot on the side, and you know, I had a speech synthesizer, and we would play like Parsec and you know all these games on that thing. And so I think like my life pretty much evolved around video games for quite a while. As far as like I think I did actually get in band for a little bit to learn how to play the flute, which only lasted a few weeks because I kept on hyperventilating.
Yeah,
So
I played the flute for 4 years, man. So
yeah. So I was like, I can't play an instrument. I mean, this feels like work.
it's funny that the instrument you played is the same one that I played, and it's one that usually guys don't play. So I was actually kind of surprised to find that out.
So I don't know. I was just yeah, I didn't do the flute thing for very long. I very quickly switched to piano because there was no hyperventilation involved. And I don't know, maybe like the computer game keyboard type of thing that was just a pretty easy transition. I don't know. It just seemed easy because all the notes were there. I didn't have to do a combination of finger presses to get a note. The piano just kind of made sense. So while I was learning the piano, of course, I would play video games a lot. Our family did not own a console. We just owned PCs. So I didn't play Mario. I didn't play Zelda. I didn't play Chrono Trigger, which I've been scolded a lot. Because of that,
I think
but
Brian's still scolding you over that.
he will still not forgive me for not playing it. I guess I need to finish it as part
Don't
of
worry,
our
Glenn. I
agreement.
forgive you.
Yeah, you forgive me. Brian won't forgive me yet. Yeah, I got him to watch Avatar: The Last Airbender, so I still need to play
The
Chrono Trigger.
cartoon series, not the movie, was.
So I played a lot of Descent was my all-time favorite game. Played a lot of stuff from Epic Mega Games, now known as just Epic Games, because I guess Epic and Mega are redundant. So Epic Games, One Must Fall, play that a lot. Unreal, play that a lot. And there's one game, Jazz Jackrabbit, that I really liked. And I think part of it was because of the music was just so awesome. I just loved the music. I would play the game just so I could listen to the music. And during this time, my brother, who was into programming and you know, kind of introduced us to a lot of the demo scene, you know, like demos, like you know, Unreal, and not to be confused with the video game Unreal, by the way. And just seeing what a lot of like seeing what Future Crew and a lot of those demo groups were doing and the music they were creating, and we would play these songs with a screen tracker. And while I was reading the manual for Jazz Jackrabbit, because I think I recently you know was able to buy it back in the old days where to buy software you had to mail. You know, get your game in the mail, you know, because this was like shareware stuff. You'd get the demo, like the first episode, from a bulletin board system. Man, this is so old school. Oh man, we connected with modems. There was like no real internet to speak of. It was just all bulletin board systems and
Be-do,
yeah, and it was all just text based. Like you would log in, it's just text based.
I remember those. Oh man. You know what? There's going to be a day when we tell our kids about those things, they're just going to look at us like two heads. You are so old.
Well, people nowadays will probably say the same thing. I mean, I talk to computer nerds all the time who don't know what a BBS is, or I guess self-proclaimed computer nerds.
What's funny is you talk to little kids now, and they don't know what a floppy disk is.
Yeah.
That's starting to make me feel old. Good word.
Yeah.
I remember all my stuff was on a floppy disk.
Yeah, so I was reading the manual for Jazz Jackrabbit, and the composer was Robert Allen, and it said that it was composed with Scream Tracker, and I was like, what? They composed that with Scream Tracker? That's what I used to play those songs with. I mean, really, I would just load them into Scream Tracker and just play the songs. I had no idea that's what they actually created that stuff with. And so then I, started poking around and realized, oh my goodness, I could have composed music just right here. It was right here, right in front of me. I had the software the whole time. And so then I started learning it. And I think at the time I was taking piano lessons. And as soon as I knew enough about reading music and playing that, I pretty much focused. I just focused on music composition. When I took private piano lessons, we didn't talk about performance. We talked about composition, which was actually bad, and I'll explain later. This is one of the big lessons that I learned in my life, but I'll get into that. So I went into composing music as quick as I could. I did my first 13 songs, which no one will ever hear. And I think just before getting into high school, I guess it was 1998. Although I think it was a little bit early, but, let's see, when was it? Oh yeah, it was. Okay. So 1998, summer of 1998, I decided
Sounds like 1998 was a good year.
It was a good year. I decided to, when I was pressured by my friend Eric to do this, to enter a demo scene music competition. It was called MC6, Music Competition 6. It was the sixth year that they've done this. And I wanted to enter into the veteran category. They had a beginners, intermediate, and veteran. I was most certainly a beginner, maybe intermediate, but I just wanted to see how well I would place. So I think at the time, Eric and I were creating a bulletin board system called a Nova Station or whatever. We had like this story about this Nova Station. I did 100 ASCII art images for it. I'm trying to remember what BBS software we used to do it. I can't remember. It was too long ago.
I'm not familiar with those anymore.
Yeah.
I haven't even looked at them in years.
Yeah, so I did the song that was based on the bulletin board system, which was based on a story kind of a thing that we were doing. And I competed against like all these greats in the demo scene community, like Awesome, Siren, also known as Alexander Brandon, who did the music for Unreal, Deus Ex, Jazz Jackrabbit 2. I love Alexander Brandon's music. He's awesome. DNA Groove, Zaron, Wayfinder, all these people. I think I placed really low in the veteran category, but I wasn't last. I think I was like 12 above last or something. But and then I started doing more music after that. And looking back, I realized that the reason why I liked music is because it was kind of telling a story. And I think we also had an album, which is where I was inspired to do this music disc called Laserium, which I never did finish. I only did the first two songs out of five. What's his name? David Arkenstone. In the Wake of the Wind was an album that he released where you would open it up and it had this map of this island. And I think on the other side was like the story for every single one of these songs. So his albums were telling a story, and I was like, that is awesome. I want to do that. So I did, an album that was kind of telling a story about this guy who was escaping from prison or whatever. I think I actually sampled, some things from The Fugitive for the sound effects for it. Cause there's like, you hear the guys breaking out and then there's like running and then people on the helicopter and yeah, all those samples, that was from The Fugitive. So I started taking music composition a little bit more seriously. I started taking music composition workshops at CalArts because that's where we live, and then I did Ashen Skies, which was a song that was actually performed live, which I thought was just awesome. It was a piano, oboe, and cello piece. Oh, that was pretty cool. And the pianist was actually the guy that played the piano for the Beauty and the Beast soundtrack. So that was pretty cool. David Loeb. He was also the music teacher at Hart High School. And then I did Oceanscape, which is kind of like a little drum and bass techno type of a thing.
I've heard that song, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, you showed me that one.
Yeah, so then after that, one of my goals, because you know how when you're growing up, people tell you to set goals or whatever, and I wanted to do music, and I wanted to do music for video games, and I would like to make video games. That was kind of my whole goal, was to, you know, make video games. And if I could do music for it, you know, great. And so my goal is to do music for Epic because I love, you know, their music inspired me to, you know, be creative and to compose. And there's a particular project called One Must Fall Battlegrounds. It was a sequel to the original One Must Fall by Divergence Entertainment. And they broke off from Epic because Epic wanted to do, you know, other things. Epic started going out of the whole shareware industry and wasn't really interested in what, you know, with what One Must Fall was, which is a big robot fighting game. So I went on the forums and I did a lot of brown nosing. I composed a song called One Must Dance as kind of a tribute to One Must Fall, which was actually a pretty good song. The music software that they were using, or the music sound system, was Direct Music, part of the DirectX library. And the only way to explain Direct Music is it was it was like a MIDI sequencer and a tracker as far as it's sample based, but it had the inconveniences of both. So what I actually ended up having to do is I ended up composing the song in Impulse Tracker, which was a next generation tracker that I started using later. I composed it in Impulse Tracker and then ported it over to Direct Music, which was a big pain in the butt. The song was called Sharp Edge, and it actually sounded pretty good. That got them to turn some heads. That was kind of where my music career, if you could call it a career, my hobby, started to kind of decline a little bit.
You call it a career. It doesn't have to earn you money to be a career.
I suppose.
My writing career.
My writing career. Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. We haven't actually released a story yet. We're working on it. Soon.
My point exactly.
Soon. And I think also during this whole One Must Fall Battlegrounds period, which I think lasted for about a year, me being pretty active on their forums, I also started learning some 3D software. And I think it might have been because my grandpa died at the time and my mind just needed something to do. So I started picking up 3D, which was like really super technical. It was probably the most difficult thing I could ever do. I doodled, but I didn't really draw. I had to get like my friends, to draw for me. Like Matt Hare did the dancing logo guy for my album cover for One Must Dance. And, Chris John did the, illustration for my robot character that I wanted to have in, you know, One Must Fall universe. So I did a 3D model of that. I did arena that used the textures from Unreal Tournament, which is another one of my favorite games. And so that's how I kind of started getting into it. And I think I actually was able, yeah, I was able to attend SIGGRAPH 1999. I went to SIGGRAPH because Chris's dad was, was kind of in the industry and was able to, you know, get us in there. I think I had to pretend to be somebody else in order to get in. But SIGGRAPH was awesome. This is the end of part one of the Hackberry Hollow podcast number 4, The Origins of Lumaglyph. Part 2 will air next week.